Judge Gaitas, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Judge Gaitas presiding.
Good morning, everyone. You may be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's great to see you all this morning in person. Today is September 21st, 2022, and we have four cases on the calendar for oral arguments. We're going to dive right into our first case this morning. I see counsel is here and ready to go. Our first case is James David Stem, DBA Principal Personnel Group versus Casey Kraus, Mari Kautzman, respondents. And the case number is A220524. Just a few words before we begin hearing your arguments this morning. Each side will have 15 minutes to present their argument. You may present the argument at the podium in the center, which will reflect the time. There's a little clock, so you can see how much time you have remaining. Alternatively, in the interest of distancing, you're also welcome to present your arguments at the two podiums that are closest to council table, whatever is comfortable for you. And finally, before you begin your argument, please identify yourself and the party you're representing, because we are making an audio recording of the arguments this morning, which will be available on the court's website shortly. So with that, I think we're ready to begin. Counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Good morning. Wayne Atkins on behalf of appellant James David Stem, and I'm a pro hoc admittee, for which I appreciate the court's being a gracious host. So there were three issues raised in the briefs on appeal. I think the one that would benefit from focusing on the most is that this jury instruction issue of payroll tax law. So I'm going to start with that, see where we end up time-wise, if it makes sense to address the other issues. So this case was a defamation case, and a number of the defamatory statements implicated federal tax law. Basically, my client accused TempWorks, or the respondents, of stealing tax money from a client, and it has to do with these 941 accounts where employee taxes are withheld. And so the relevant jury instruction was the following, because I really want to focus on the language of this instruction. And it gets into tax law. This is something the district court herself requested an instruction on this issue because it was relevant to the case. And it says, generally, once money is paid into the account of a taxpayer by whatever party, those funds are the property of the taxpayer, and only the taxpayer is authorized to claim or receive a refund or return of those funds. Now, if we just stopped there, I don't think we'd have any issue, but then she got into three exceptions, and that's where we really start to have an issue on appeal. The one that's really most relevant here is, she said, however, certain exceptions exist to this general rule, which include when a tax payment is made on behalf of a taxpayer, but such taxpayer commits fraud against the payer of the tax payment related to the existence of employees. And then the other two exceptions are administrative error and declare a tax lien. And that comes up in this case because respondents are, one of them, ARA Inc., was basically, I think they're called a factoring company, where they finance the payroll of temporary employment agencies. And so they had this client, JG Staffing, they were a temp agency. They had Waste Management, who they were doing work for, as their main client. And I guess the evidence showed, or there was evidence that they'd almost inflate the invoices they got from Waste Management to get them financed, and then offer kind of these off-the-book discounts to Waste Management after the fact. But that was after our ARA, the respondent, one of the respondents, had financed that payroll. So I guess this came to light, and the respondents took it upon themselves to take this money. They reached out to the IRS because they were, as a payroll processing company, they had some authority from JG Staffing to interact with the IRS. And that led into, I guess, what's called in these statements the theft of this tax money. And a little bit after that, the IRS reversed that, undid it. But it was temporarily, I guess, transferred from, it was JG Staffing's 941 account, and it was transferred to TempWorks or ARA Inc.'s. Or the respondent companies are used a little interchangeably in the record, so it's kind of hard to parse the companies.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
Just so I understand the mechanics. So it was the IRS that made the transfer, correct? It was not TempWorks that went in and was able to manipulate it and...
Correct. Okay. The IRS physically...
That's what I assumed, but I just wanted to make sure. Okay.
Under direction, I mean, it's a little unclear what the interaction was, but TempWorks, one of their employees, reached out to the IRS, and that led up to the transfer. What actually was said is, I think, a little unclear in the trial transcript, but it's the IRS who physically transferred it, I guess, from... Or I don't know if it's physically, because it's probably just accounting in the abstract, but transferred from one 941 account to the other, and then it was reversed later by the IRS, and there's a little inconsistency in the record about the exact timing of that, whether it was a month or a year. Regardless,
Atkins, one concern that I have is that this is a really dense instruction. I mean, I, as a lawyer, have some difficulty even understanding what it's saying, and I'm wondering how... Given the complexity of the instruction and the concepts that are discussed in the instruction, how it prejudiced the jury?
It's precisely because of that density, because I agree, I don't do tax law. Payroll tax is something that's very different to me. So I think that's why we initially proffered the expert on this issue to testify, hopefully break it down for the jury. And I mean, that's a slightly different issue. But I think it's that density of that instruction that creates, is why it's so important to get it right, because it increases the likelihood of confusing the jury on this very issue. And that's why it's very important, especially with some of these tax terms of arts, to be very precise in how we use them and make sure they accurately reflect the law, because it only increases the potential for jury confusion. Any little mistake gets magnified manyfold, just given the density of this instruction. So this exception when the taxpayer commits fraud against the payer of the tax related to the existence of the employees, that doesn't exist in any law, not phrased like that. What was relied on was this, it was called an action on decision from the IRS, and that's the IRS saying, well, we don't really want to appeal it, here's our reasons why. I guess the court in that case, there was a fictitious employee there created by another employee, and that employee was...
Can I ask you another question? So let's assume that this was some kind of an error by the district court, including this exception. But there was significant discussion of that during your closing argument. And there was a full opportunity to explain this to the jury and help them understand. So why shouldn't we just conclude, well... Maybe an error, but not a reversible error.
Well, the significant discussion of the issue only makes it even more of an error, because it's, well, first of all, there's an underlying misstatement of law, and it's also described in closing argument a little inaccurately, I think, by the respondents, where they interchangeably use a taxpayer and payer of the tax in their argument, which taxpayer is a kind of legal term of art in tax law, particularly in this context when there's a third party paying the tax. But I can see a lay jury not drawing that distinction. They'd have no way of necessarily knowing it's a legal term of art. But I think the fact that it was discussed makes it even more important that we get it right in the first place, because it's something that was a focus of the parties and presumably and somewhat corroborated by the verdict form, one the jury took to heart and impacted some of their decision-making. But,
okay, so the defamatory statements here, though, were that things like the CEO was found guilty by the IRS of illegally moving money. So that doesn't have anything to do with an exception. That's saying that the IRS found the CEO guilty of illegal conduct. And, I mean... How could the jury be confused about that by this one sentence in an instruction? That's what I'm struggling about.
So you're correct. Those are the statements. But this exception kind of justifies their conduct, and the respondents even used it in closing to justify their conduct, because they're expanding this exception to be sort of this general fraud exception. When they're defrauded, they have the right to kind of take these monies that are supposed to be held in trust by statute for the benefit of the employees, not even JG Staffing. So they're using it to justify their conduct. And not only that, the fact that they're found guilty, that language found guilty, the jury didn't get hung up so much on those terms. You can see in some of their other findings where they found it true that respondents were guilty of defamation, even though there was no adjudication showing guilt in that. So I don't think that term was something, I think the jury recognized that for what it was, rhetorical hyperbole. I don't know if that answers your question or not. But
is there a difference between whether the conduct was justified and whether the conduct amounted to a theft? The latter being, of course, the statements that were alleged to be defamatory.
I don't know that there's a distinction that I can think of that would certainly not apply here. If you justify your conduct, it would not be a theft. It'd probably be some accounting, like debating a legal question with the IRS. I don't think there's a distinction that makes a difference here, because I think it's still a theft. If it's unjustified. If it's justified, I guess it wouldn't be a theft. So, no, sorry, you look like you're about to talk.
I don't want to interrupt.
Oh, sorry. So, no, I don't think it matters here. The fact that they had this justification and that it was cloaked in this jury instruction, I think gave the jury an out to say, no, okay, I guess they're allowed to do that. There's a jury, the judge told us they can do that, so that's not a theft. So I think they really did parse the guilty, non-guilty thing in that manner in the jury instruction.
I just want to make sure I understand. So you're saying the jury instruction included an error of law because that first exception that you've been talking about, the fictitious employee section, however you want to characterize it, came from an IRS action on decision not to appeal a case, as opposed to something in the IRS statute or rules. I mean, is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little broader than that, but yes, I think at the core that is it, because it's the IRS deciding not to appeal. And the reason they're deciding not to appeal is they're like, well, there's a question where there's a fictitious employee of whether there's even wages in the first place. So that's, even if you're looking at that reasoning, that's not really an exception. That's the general rule, because in the first place, to fall within that general rule, it has to be funds paid on behalf of a taxpayer. So if there's no taxpayer,
I just worry about how far down the road you go saying that's not the law. Because if you think about it, just stepping back, we look to how agencies interpret their own laws all the time in, you know, bulletins and guidance. So all of that, you'd say, would be, if you know, we couldn't rely on that to say that's the law?
Well, we do, but that's not what happened here for a couple reasons. One, I mean, yeah, we have cases saying this isn't precedent. This is just the IRS choosing not to appeal. There's a separate regulatory process for interpreting laws, and that's a different than deciding not to appeal a particular case because there's a legal question about whether there's even wages in the first place, and there was $1,800 an issue in that particular case. So it's them saying for strategic reasons, we don't want to appeal this.
May I turn to another issue, which I know you haven't reached yet, but I did want to just make sure you had...
Of course, I asked you about,
and that's your relate back argument. You state in your brief that you weren't able to find Minnesota cases dealing with this specific issue. So I just wanted to hear from you. Should we make this a presidential opinion? And if we did, what would our holding, our syllabus point be related on that relation back issue?
Right. So there's kind of this. We know from Minnesota cases, there's one Supreme Court case that shows, in the context of sort of the related issue that was briefed below of republication for the purposes of when the statute of limitations starts to accrue. And in that context, the Minnesota Supreme Court said in, I think, Weinberger v. Maplewood in 2003, that basically there's separate publication, separate audience, separate injury, it's a separate cause of action. So to apply that to relation back, it's hard to say it's not republication in one context, but it relates back in another. So it's that, I guess, if it's not a republication, then it can't relate back because it would have been barred in the first place. So I don't know exactly how that's going to be worded in the form of an opinion, but I think that's the core issue there. It's hard to reconcile that it was found to be not republications for accrual, but it was implicitly found to relate back to those not republished statements, particularly given the guidance we got from the Supreme Court saying basically separate injury, separate audience, separate cause of action.
And then just following up on that issue, is it true that you didn't raise the issue below about the 10 new statements in the second amended complaint and that they don't relate back?
That is true. It was never presented in that manner below. They were only focused on the issue, which I think is closely related, of republication. But the specific argument of relation back of the new statements, that I would agree was not expressly raised below.
And so how should we, I mean, why shouldn't we find that that was forfeited?
Sure. A couple reasons. One, the way the judge ultimately ruled where kind of foreclosed any further statute of limitations argument on summary judgment. That's one point. Two, there's case law saying...
And what do you base that on?
So in the end result of... I don't have the cite in my notes here, but as part of the summary judgment ruling, she kind of... What was argued about republication was argued in the summary judgment motions. There were cross summary judgment motions.
The partial summary judgment motion. Right.
As a result of that, it stripped pretty much the statute of limitations affirmative defense from being argued to the jury. She said, okay, you made your arguments on this. I agree with the respondents. We're not arguing about statute of limitations to the jury. So that prevented it from being further developed. Also, there's case law saying this idea of waiver in this context, it isn't ironclad. You kind of have to look to the prejudice to the parties. And because this is so related to what was argued, I don't believe it is waived. And I see I am out of time. So
thank you for your argument.
You'll
have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, or good morning, Your Honors. My name is Daniel Craig. I'm counsel for the respondents in this matter. So as Mr. Atkin pointed out, we have three issues. I'll address them in the same order that he did. So let's talk first about the jury instructions. There were two instructions on the legal definition of theft actually given that are not at issue in this appeal, one on the state law theft statute and one on the federal theft statute. Those are really the apposite statutes to the question presented to the jury of whether the statements regarding whether Mr. Dergarian or TempWorks were found guilty of theft or stealing. And of course, it's really undisputed in this record that they were never found guilty of theft or stealing. I submit, Your Honors, that this entire issue is, I don't know whether to describe this more as a red herring or a straw man. I'll say it's a straw man because I think it was evident to Mr. Stem and as part of his legal strategy that he simply could not produce evidence to show that my clients were thieves, found guilty of theft, or things of the like. And you'll see in their brief there's some complaint about that, about the notion of, well, gosh, we couldn't subpoena the IRS because we think there's some other version of the story here. Well, they couldn't subpoena the IRS. They could have submitted a TUI request under the IRS's regulations for the disclosure of documents and testimony. They could have gone and deposed JG Staffing to hear their side of events. So what the jury heard was essentially a just my client's version of events, and it's undisputed because of that. So what is that story, or what did we prove at trial on this issue? ARA is in the factoring business. It engages in a transaction where it purchases accounts receivable at a discount in order to essentially lend money to a business that needs to close a cash flow gap. It discovered that one of its clients, JG Staffing, had been inflating the value of waste management invoices, I believe among others. And essentially, ARA had been advancing funds on JG's behalf that was ARA's money because of the fraud. And so as part of its agreement with JG, it had paid a number of its bills, things, you know, paid vendors and paid taxes. And so what the testimony showed is ARA would send, on behalf of all of its clients at a given payment period, a large wire to the IRS, and then it would provide payment advice as to how to apply it. And for some time, a little line on that payment advice would have said, go ahead and apply this to JG Staffing. When it discovers the fraud, realizes it's been sending house money essentially to the IRS and noting that it should be applied to JG, it petitioned its government, as it has a right to do under the First Amendment, called up the IRS and said, can we get our money back? Initially, the IRS said yes, and then it changed its mind, and it said no. That is not...
So focusing on the jury instruction, though, I mean, that this AOD, I'm sympathetic to the argument that it's not an IRS position statement saying, under these specific circumstances, we will move money back from withholding account to the whoever's claiming fraud in this case. I mean, it is a stretch, I will say. I mean, I'm not saying I'm concluding that, but let's assume that. So you know, that kind of gets to the heart. I mean, you heard appellant's argument here, you know, whether this was illegal or not. So, you know, why couldn't that have just been plain old misleading? You succeeded in keeping out their tax experts, so you didn't have somebody on the stand explaining it. So why shouldn't we say, geez, you know, this is on pretty shaky grounds and it could have confused the jury?
Well, let me address the first part first, Your Honor, and say I agree that perhaps this document wouldn't be entitled to something like Chevron deference as a big action of the agency. But courts rely on a lot less in receiving agency guidance, you know, unofficial manuals, statements to the public, as this clearly is, in allowing agencies to interpret their own regulations. But again, setting that aside and addressing it, what I'm saying here on the immateriality of the instruction is that what this instruction is purporting to be essentially the IRS's own rule of decision for how it would process a claim. This is a rule that applies to the IRS and how they're going to make a decision. It has nothing to do with whether my clients robbed the United States Treasury. It's indisputed that they didn't do that. They didn't take any money. They didn't steal any money. They asked their government for redress. As we noted, we objected to this entire instruction in principle because it just doesn't have anything to do with the liability in this case. Our judge seemed to agree with that, saying that it didn't really have anything to do with liability. It was just this kind of background or context for the claims. And so that's how I would respond, Your Honor, is essentially the whole issue itself doesn't matter. It has no relevance whatsoever to the statements. And I think tellingly in their brief, appellants did not explain how it truly affects all of the claims that they say it does. They just say there are seven things to deal with the tax issue and you know, a bunch of others referring to thieves and things like that. That's not good enough. They bear the burden of persuasion on this appeal. They have to explain to this court how this claimed error was actually material and affected the jury's decision in this case. Which it did not, because it's a sideshow. It doesn't matter how the IRS would decide this, which is why we pointed out, again, you know, it doesn't become theft based on the IRS's decision. If the IRS had agreed with my clients and sustained the transfer, that shouldn't be material one way or another. It just doesn't matter what the IRS's decision is, because it's the IRS's decision. It's not my client stealing or engaging in theft.
If it's okay with the panel, can I switch to the relation back issue for a minute? Now, defamation is something that needs to be pled with specificity. And so how can new, I mean, let's assume that they were new, you know, republications. How can that possibly relate back? I mean, we do require in the state of Minnesota that defamatory statements be specifically set out in the complaint with enough detail so that you can figure out who said what when. It's not the kind of thing where you say, geez, I was defamed, and then you get to add, you know, 2 years down the road, the specificity. So I am troubled by that argument.
Well, let me put it this way, Your Honor. First off, I don't think the case law justifies that there is a different pleading standard for defamation. It's not a Rule 9 listed item. But for the purposes of this discussion...
No, it's not fraud, but there is plenty of case law to that effect.
And I'll say, setting it aside to address your point, Your Honor, there's an important interplay between Rule 15.03, which is a procedural rule for fairness, and the substantive law of defamation. And so what the appellant here is saying is that they're asking for a broad rule that says defamation never relates back. The entire purpose of Rule 15.03 and its federal counterpart, 15C, is to save claims for fairness reasons that the defendant had fair notice of. And the comments to the federal rule make clear that the rule is designed to be lenient, and if there is a statute that creates more leniency, that statute should control.
Do you have any case law to that effect? Because I do think, I mean, you want your bread and have it buttered too. You want to be able to keep your claims saying, no, they're new claims, they were republished. They're to a different audience, they're on a different platform, but, oh, we get to add things later that are post what would have been the statute of limitations.
And let me tell you...
And what this judge would have thrown out if you'd included them in the original complaint. So why am I wrong about that?
Because the test under Rule 15.03 is about procedural fairness and notice, not liability, which is going to be a more hard and fast rule. So one of the cases that I think is important to understand this distinction here. So the appellant cited Pruis versus Boss. It's a New York case. And that cited a case, Contemporary Mission, Inc. versus New York Times, 665 F sup 248. Now, in that case, the court permitted new claims in an amended pleading to relate back. Because the new claims were in the same letter, but not pled prior before. Now, in our pleadings, we listed three essential documents that we were drawing our claims from in the first complaint and the first amended complaint. Those three documents were the Beware of TempWorks page, the Beware of TempWorks Facebook page, and the Beware of TempWorks, or the 180 Personnel Twitter feed. And we included in there that our claims we're listing out include but are not limited to, but identified those three sources of information. And so if you go to the Begay case, a Minnesota Supreme Court case on Rule 15.03, they essentially list three factors, whether the defendant had notice of the claim that the plaintiff is now asserting, whether the plaintiff will rely on the same kind of evidence offered in support of the original claim to prove the new claim, and whether unfair surprise to the defendant would result if the court allowed the amendment. One more thing from Contemporary Mission, the court there says a defendant knows the entire transaction will be scrutinized, and in this they're referring to the letter. We had put Mr. Stem on notice in our first complaint that all three of those web pages would be scrutinized by identifying statements for them, saying to include but not limited to. And so while that maybe that first complaint could not have found led to liability for unpled statements, but it gave fair notice that we were going to be doing discovery, we were going to be going through the court process, and that, in fairness, could have resulted in an amendment, so he was on notice from the original pleading.
So the added statements, though, were on the same date, different dates, different postings? I mean, I'll go back and look.
No, they would be from different dates, but it's important. We're talking here about what he would have had at the time of case filing. At the time of case filing, so all of these statements predate case filing, right? This is not a supplemental pleading. So at the time of case filing, when our pleading says, beware of TempWorks webpage, Twitter, and Facebook, he's on notice of all of his statements in those documents. Therefore, this is the procedural fairness issue. He got notice. Entire point of Rule 15.03.15c, we don't try to project the substantive law into this rule. We only look at procedural fairness in the case and what they had notice of. In the sense, the pleading defect itself cannot be the basis to deny the relation back. It's, did you have notice? Was it fair? Because the whole point of an amended complaint is to cure the pleading defect, which our judge found we needed to plead those every single statement, and we did.
Where did the judge say you needed to plead every single statement?
The appellants made a motion to dismiss. It may have been for a more definite statement, but it was certainly a motion to dismiss. And Judge Kyle then at that time ordered us to replead with specificity on the date of publication. So that was essentially relief that they obtained, saying that our pleading was defective for not listing all statements.
Did appellant forfeit the issue?
What's that, Your Honor?
Did appellant forfeit the issue?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this was raised for the first time in this court. It wasn't even discussed in a motion for new trial. The statute of limitations wasn't even raised at trial. So this is absolutely forfeited. Certainly, it should have been raised in the district court. I mean, you will not find a citation to Rule 15.03 anywhere in the trial court record. You will not see the mention of relation back in the trial court record. So it's forfeited. There was also a mistake here in appealing from an order denying summary judgment. The case law is absolutely clear that is not part of the scope of review. This court doesn't have the power to even reach the issue of an order denying summary judgment on appeal. So I would say the interest of justice exception is, simply doesn't apply to that because it's beyond the scope of review by the interpretation of the scope of review rule. So it's doubly forfeited. With that, Your Honor, I could take one more question within my time.
I'm not seeing any other questions.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Your Honors.
Thank you for your argument.
Good morning. We brought up this issue of Chevron deference, I guess, was touched on with regard to the action on decision. First of all, there's no deference, and I cited an 11th Circuit case in the brief McKinney that says, and which I think was itself relying on an IRS manual, it says, these actions on decisions, they're not precedent, they're just guidance, they're our internal review, this is just the chief counsel's reasons for not appealing. Not only that, but the IRS has a process to provide guidance on rules. They can make regulations. This isn't a regulation, this is just the chief counsel there saying, we're not going to appeal this. But if you look at the action on decision, it never says this exception. It just says there's a question in this particular case with a fictitious employee. There might be a question. There might be no wages at all because there's no employee from which to pull those wages from. So it's not so much an exception. It just doesn't fit within the general rule, which is that I think the statute says money is held in trust once it's withheld from payroll taxes. And just like a creditor of a lawyer can't pull from that lawyer's trust accounts when their client pays them money, a third party here can't just pull from employees' money that's supposed to be held in trust and withheld from their taxes. And I think it did, and the standard here for jury instructions and whether they warrant a new trial is the potential to mislead the jury. And I think that's here in spades because it was relied on by certainly counsel for respondents in closing. The judge herself even found it, the reason that instruction's there because the judge said, hey, I think this is relevant to at least some of the counts. So I think it's wrong. It's an exception that would almost swallow the other exceptions, which are just narrow administrative error and leanness, almost gives all companies who do this factoring of financing payroll taxes and payroll like a free tax lien by creating an exception from this where they can almost exercise this a bit of self-help. But the IRS ultimately reversed it, but just because they were caught
stealing doesn't make the statements not stealing in the first place. And because this instruction was relied on so heavily by the parties in argument, I think it shows that it was used as a justification for these theft statements. And then I will, I guess, circle back to one issue that came up with regard to the statute of limitations. I think I covered the kind of waiver point already in my initial presentation. But another point that was brought up at the end by counsel was that it's summary judgment rulings aren't appealable. That's not completely true. And the reason is that on questions of law, it is. There's a case I cited in the reply brief on this point called Schmitz that says questions of law can still be reviewed on appeal from summary judgment rulings. But also the basis for that underlying propositions that in most cases when summary judgment's denied, it's because the jury has going to hear and weigh evidence, the issue's tried. But here it wasn't tried because the end result of the various summary judgment motions in the case is the judge said no more statute of limitations defense. They were cross motions for summary judgment, except for I think there were a couple statements where it could still be argued. But as a general rule, the statute of limitations issue is completely resolved at a legal level on summary judgment. So it really wasn't tried. So that rule doesn't apply. So unless there's a other specific questions, I would just close by asking for a reversal and new trial. The precise relief's a little more spelled out clearly in the conclusions to the two briefs we submitted.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you both for your very helpful arguments this morning. The case is now submitted to us, and we will issue